there is a lot of performance in D2C, and we saw a lot of success in that model, but there was always the sentiment, and we are always developing brand strategies and brand activations. Now it's just a matter of rebalancing and not starting from scratch.
Welcome to Growth Notes, presented by InBeat Agency. Each week, we discuss the essentials of D2C marketing, paid growth, and influencer strategies. Hear from consumer marketing industry leaders who provide transformative insights and share innovative advertising tactics that enhance e-commerce success.
All right, guys. Today, I'm joined by Marcelo Cortez. Marcelo Cortez is the CMO at Manscaped, and I am excited to have a discussion around brand marketing and performance marketing. But beforehand, it's nice to have you on the show, Marcelo.
Thanks, David. Thanks for welcoming me here. And I love talking about marketing, brand marketing, performance marketing, creatives. I'm looking forward.
Yeah, I'm super excited about this one. We had a nice conversation pre-interview, and there was a lot of points that I was just excited to hear about. So before we get started, do you want to just jump in and tell people how you got to where you are? How do you become the CMO of Manscaped? How does this story unfold? And what do you do?
Sure. And it's a bit of a winding road, but I'll try to pick the highlights for us. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not originally from the US. I am from Brazil. And I started my professional life in the creative, in traditional advertising creative. I had the privilege of belonging to an industry that is very strong in Brazil. There's a lot of amazing creatives heading companies all over the world from Brazil. But I was always like, I always wanted to learn more, right? When in my days as a creative, I felt that we needed to go closer to the strategy, closer to the business needs and to solving actual problems. I had this passion for strategy that wouldn't let me keep quiet on just as a creative, at least in the traditional sense of the word. So I ended up doing a few political campaigns actually in Brazil, because that gave me the chance to really test strategy, really run things in a high intense environment. Like altogether, I ended up doing 7 presidential campaigns in 5 different countries, 3 of them in Brazil. And I was lucky enough to win 6 out of the 7. So it was a good track record. It was a good stretch. But I always kept going back to advertising and working for brands. I did work for Budweiser in Brazil and other big brands as well. But after my 7th political campaign, I had made a decision to take a year off and come to the US, bring my family. It was a way to reconnect with the family, because as you imagine, doing all these campaigns would take a toll on like your family life. So we ended up in Encinitas here, close to San Diego, where I live today. What was supposed to be just a 1 year off regrouping with the family and reaping the benefits of the hard work ended up becoming a new chapter in our lives. We decided to stay here, and I had to restart my professional life here. I did not want to move out of Encinitas. I knew if I wanted to get back to advertising, I would have to either go to Chicago, New York, San Francisco, but I was very stubborn that I wanted to make it from here. And I ended up launching a few brands of my own. I launched a non-alcoholic gin brand called Drink Monday, a coffee brand. And then through one of these brands, I ended up meeting Manscaped CEO Paul Tran. And in the first chat, we talked about doing some tweaks to the brand and the branding. But as I got exposed to the brand more and more, both Paul and I realized that there was a huge potential and a larger job to be done. And we could maybe deepen and strengthen that partnership. So he invited me to join the company. I made what at the time to me was like a crazy risky pitch, but I did offer him. I said, I will join if you let me run everything that has an ounce of creative on it. And that included product design, packaging, digital advertising. And he was on board. We had a lot of progress right from the get-go. We revamped the brand. We created like typography systems. We created new packaging, a new design language for Manscaped products. And then our bond got stronger too. And then a couple of years ago, he invited me to get creative and marketing together in the same group. And then I would become the chief marketing officer running creative and marketing at Manscaped. And that's where we are. So that's how I got there. Sorry, it was a long road. No. But it's not the traditional marketing background or career path.
Yeah, but that usually creates the best marketing, right? Difference in approaches is what creates great marketing. So yeah, I think Manscaped's got pretty rich history of building a strong humoristic brand. And it's been, I'm a YouTube consumer, so I've seen a lot of Manscaped sponsorships throughout my life. So it's fun to see where Manscaped is right now. And I guess that can get us into the next discussion, which is, what are you currently working on at Manscaped? What are the challenges? What is the marketing approach? And we can just dissect that.
Yeah, for sure. And so that it's never been a dull moment at Manscaped. That's something that I really embrace and appreciate, because I am a very anxious person by nature and I need new challenges every day. Right now, I think the biggest challenge that we have in front of us is that transition from what we used to be a D2C first company, even though Manscaped was omnichannel from the very early years. And Manscaped was also multi-product very early on, but from planting the seed of being omnichannel to really becoming an omnichannel organization is a transition. And because a lot of our early success was heavily banked on performance marketing and digital channels, shifting to a more balanced approach is not necessarily easy. It is a good challenge. I think we have an amazing team that has always done brand marketing in some capacity. We always had like presence both in brand partnerships, events, sponsorships, and even like brand content as well. But just leaning harder into that and serving our omnichannel footprint in a more balanced way, I think that's still a little bit of a challenge. And I say challenge with a very positive tone to it, right? It's not like one of those challenges where you feel deflated or tired or like you don't have the energy to tackle. It's an exciting new chapter. And what I think it makes it even more exciting, at least to me, is as I look to similar companies on similar paths, I feel like there's a lot of learnings from direct to consumer, brick and mortar, and how those dynamics play and how they evolve over time, right? Because we have to remember that direct to consumer is still a pretty young event or discipline.
Yeah,
or
lots of retail brand that went from retail to D2C, and then you're doing the other way around, where now you're building a brand that's omnichannel, distributed everywhere, and that's thinking about marketing in the other way. And it's a playbook that's not fully written yet. And that's pretty exciting. I mean, I'd love to ask you, what are some brands you look up to? And, when you do your research and you're like, wow, these guys get it. And I'm curious to know what you'd look at.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, because I think I've been looking more at brands that sometimes are not getting it because I don't want to incur on similar mistakes than the ones that are getting it. Because I feel like there's still a lot of struggle in that transition, and even understanding what are the strengths of D2C, what are the strengths of the retail channel, and understanding how you play those strengths off, I think it's still pretty new. I don't see a lot of great examples to follow like on that specific path, but I do see like brands that are doing a really good job on their omni-channel support and supporting across channels and all of that. But I think one of the things that for me was very interesting was when I started looking back at direct to consumer, it's a 10 to 12, maybe 13, 14, doesn't matter, depending on how you look at the starting point. But it's a pretty relative, it's a new channel, right? It's still pretty fresh. And on top of that, I think we had COVID that came in and changed the dynamics. For some companies, it was tailwinds, which was our case at Manscaped. For some others, there were headwinds, but it also, I think, helped delay a little bit the understanding of how far can a D2C first approach take you and what you need to do to transition. And what I mean by that is, I think D2C has amazing strengths. Like when I look back, first thing it did for brands, and especially new brands, was it allowed a challenger brand like us to show up to the consumer looking great, right? Before D2C, to get past the barrier of entering a big retailer so you can have exposure to your brand was really hard. And you needed to be at a level that was not for a young challenger brand like ours. D2C, because it allowed you to show up directly to your consumer in a beautiful digital environment, it could actually allow a brand like Manscaped to show up looking as good as a like 100-year-old brand like Gillette, because it's digital mediums. It's not that complicated to just show up with nice looking products, good message, and trying to solve people's problems. So that is like one of the most amazing, in my opinion, aspects of D2C. But we have to understand that this might not be the same quality that takes you over as you have bigger ambitions to grow. And that's where I think a lot of people get stuck.
But I think, like you said, D2C gives you that, you know, that fast track to market-ish where you don't have to go through buyers and retailers and then fight for premium shelf space and then make a name. It's a lot easier now, I assume, for Manscaped to get premium shelf space and retailers now that you've built the D2C. It's like you proved the model and now it's you're ready for the next chapter. It makes it easier to grow in there.
Yeah, I know. It actually flips the script and you can have an MVP product. You can have a hypothesis that it's confirmed directly by the consumers. Yes, on that sense, I think it's amazing. And that's another, there's a couple other aspects that I think that makes D2C and performance marketing, that combination, very compelling. The other thing that I call out is it allows you, and that very sense of kind of testing and proving your theory, it allows you to do smaller bets, right? On the combination of performance marketing and direct to consumer, you can make smaller bets on like how you are trying to convey your idea or bring your consumer on the journey with you without having to do huge productions and spend multi-million dollars on a, you know, broadcast nationwide campaign. You can really do small bets and learn. And this test and learn ability is amazing. It's another thing that gets us very much hooked on the combination of performance and D2C. And the third aspect that I think also is great, but also makes the switch later more difficult, is the more scientific nature of it, if I might. Like, it's probably a little bit less of an art and more of a science in terms of you can deploy media and message and read the results and fine tune, you know, immediately. It's very easy to read. It's very comforting to see results. And it's very comforting to see what's working, what's not, and keep pushing on the right track. But what it doesn't give you is, in my opinion, that mass reach that at some point you need to really get efficient. Because the one broken thing about this model that I think few people stop to realize or at least rationalize is the very nature of the combination of performance marketing and direct to consumer brings the opposite dynamic of an economy of scale. Let me explain a little better. Because of the nature of the performance channels that they have been developed and fine-tuned for this last decade to put your message in front of the most likely to convert person, right? So yes, they do a great job at that. So it's very exciting. But just by the same logic, if your number one ad is being put in front of the most likely to convert person, your number two ad is going to be put in front of a slightly less likely to convert person. And then the number three will be slightly less. And that's all good when you're talking about like 10,000 people, 100,000 people. But when you start to talk about millions of people, like we've sold over 10 million ball trimmers alone, that scaling becomes harder and harder because now you're having to talk to the people who are not even on that bottom of the funnel, like closer to conversion. And you need to start thinking about generating more audience to your products. And that's where I think when you get hooked on the performance and D2C model alone, it becomes a problem because you start to lose efficiency and you try to come up with why this is happening. And sometimes people get stuck in that loop.
you over-optimize for a certain subset of people, and then you're just trying to re-optimize for these people. Because when you try to go into another segment, all of a sudden the cost per acquisition goes up. So you're like, let's go back to the initial segment. So you're never ending up growing into other segments. So works, as you said, to grow to eight figures. But like when you get into nine figures, then it breaks because you need to address all of these other markets. Yeah. So I guess
exactly. And what happens a lot is by that time, you have a culture that gets that was built for that system, that was built for that dynamic, and it becomes hard to change. Like I said, the good thing about Manscaped was that Paul Tran, our CEO and founder, and the marketing team that he built even before I was in the marketing team, like always had that sentiment. There is a lot of performance in D2C, and we saw a lot of success in that model, but there was always the sentiment, and we are always developing brand strategies and brand activations. Now it's just a matter of rebalancing and not starting from scratch. But it's still, even for us, knowing all that, it's still a challenge because yes, you develop some muscles a little more than others, and now you have to re-understand your body and start lifting weights with the left hand a little more and that kind of thing.
And then the reporting calls are a bit different, right? It's okay, what do we report on here? What this feels different. I don't have a clear CAC to give you. And it changes the game a lot.
It changes a lot. And I can give you one example like that I think a lot of people that probably might be in the same space might relate to. There's one of timing, for example, right? On the combination of performance in D2C, first, you are in control of the time, right? You can drop products, you can drop new messaging, you can drop promotions, whatever your brand does, you can drop it at a heartbeat. And you can start seeing the result also at a heartbeat. As you change that investment to support, let's say, the retail channel, for example, the cycles are longer because first, just the relationship with the retailers are of a longer nature. They need plans and more in advance, and you need to be slotted for those spaces, and you need to have your products ready for launch way more in advance. And then on the media side as well, those are not investments that you read the results immediately. They sometimes take, depending on who you ask, from 6 to 18 months to really read the results. So when you have an organization that is pretty much hooked on that daily report and seeing exactly what the money is bringing back, it's very hard to change. And sometimes you probably can see companies where people get so hooked into that even though they're not seeing the efficiency in that performance/digital sale, they keep pushing that channel because it's more comforting to have an immediate result, even though the result is not what you're asking for and what you need, then go into a space where the results are harder to read. Yeah. And it's an interesting thing to observe because it plays with human nature, but it's totally, if you stop and think, it doesn't make sense. But how do you get out of that rabbit hole in a way?
I guess the way you're thinking about this is like, all right, we're going to retail, we're in specific stores, and we need to tie our media plan to that retail appearance. And then you're planning years in advance, and it's just a very hard to recoup the investment. You're investing a lot of money up front in inventory, in creating the creatives and placements. You're securing all of that so that when your retail drop happens, you can reap it. But it's not easy, I assume, to just see what the impact is. It's not we got X amount of customers today from X amount of spend on Facebook. We're not here.
Yeah. And of course, the vast majority of marketers are dealing with a preset budget that has limitations. I'm yet to find a situation or to find myself in a situation where you have unlimited funds. So what happens too is you might have this money, this media investment that is right now working on performance and digital channels, and you're getting that immediate result. CACs are getting higher. Things are getting more difficult. But then when you scale something back and you put on an omni-channel campaign that will support across channels, but with a different timeline, how do you make for that gap, right? How do you make from the gap where you're taking off from less efficient performance channels and activations and putting on a brand or omni-channel campaign that you know can be more efficient on the long run, but because of the nature of this is super high speed, immediate results, and this takes, like we said, from 6 to 18 months to give you a good read of the result, what do you do in that meantime? Because it's very hard to find a situation where you can just bring more money to develop the omni-channel and not touch your performance D2C channel. So that's the trick. And that's why you need to be very strategic. I think that being like having a good, strong relationship with the leadership in the company on one end and being very communicative with your marketing team becomes crucial. And I think at Manscaped, we have a good, strong environment that thankfully makes that very doable. Yeah,
how do you push through that? Right now, that's your transition. That's where you are, right? It's okay. We've got performance and then we've got brand and then we need to find a way to have the two together, but you need to convince people that brand is important. Like, how do you work through that right now? What does the process look like?
Yeah.
It feels like
it's hard. And that's, I think that's where you need to really prove your leadership skills, right? Because it is about leadership. If you think about this whole idea of leadership, you know, it's paving a path, is building confidence from the team, is kind of, and that you have different people, both from your other peers at leadership and from the teams that will react to different stimuli. So you need to use all, like, everything that you have, from data to back you up, to case studies, to showing what your hypothesis is, to communicating over and over again, having the resilience to communicate and go over questions and go over hesitations and go over doubts. And I think being open to, one of the things that I personally love, and I foster that at Manscaped a lot, is I love people challenging whatever direction, strategy, or path that we have, because it gives me one of two things, right? If someone is challenging a direction, a proposal, a strategy, and either I really believe that we are on the right direction and I should have really good arguments to at least engage in a great debate about why, like even hearing that, I still believe that this is the direction, this is the place to go. It gives you that moment to reinforce even to yourself that you are on the right direction, gives you that chance to reassess and talk yourself through as you're talking to someone else why we are making these things, why we're taking those steps. And on the other hand, I always keep my mind open to, yeah, sometimes there's things that are being brought that needs fine-tuning, right? So if someone within the organization raises a question, a lot of times, like, hey, there's merit here and there's things that we can change to address that. And that sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean that you are changing direction, but you are course correcting. So I think that the communication element is extremely important in both ways, not just telling people what you're trying to accomplish, but also keeping that channel open and really incentivizing people to speak up and even to ask questions. Because one of the things that this, the nature of the change implies, is that if we're going to do things differently, that means that it's not our comfort zone. So yes, there will be people in the organization that are going to say, hey, I don't know exactly what I'm doing, or I don't know exactly how to get there, and I don't know exactly what should I do next. And creating the space where they can talk about those things with confidence and not feeling like they are behind or that they are not appropriate because they don't know, is very important. And that's something that I do my best to keep that environment like as open as it can. I think
It seems to always come back to humans, and it's just about humans and making sure that you're a good leader. And these concepts were very fuzzy to me when I started in business, and now they seem to make so much more sense as the company grows and we have more and more employees. I'm starting to realize there's a lot more than buzzwords in these things, and you realize, oh, okay, it is, and change management is a thing. It is a thing. People don't react well, and you need to think about it and do it from, yeah.
Now, and I have to say, I felt the same way. When I had a little hesitancy with the word leadership. I always thought, what is that? People talk about leadership skills, leadership traits. And I'm like, it all sounds like a little bit of BS. But there is truth to it, right? There is, it's not by chance that I think there's value in every human contribution. I think that having like rock stars in your team, that they're not about growth or ambition, but they are about doing the best on what they love doing. And it's important to have those balances.
Yeah.
But some people, yes, their skill set, their traits are to help us go through uncertainty, go through times where we don't really know what we are doing, and there's change and there's hesitancy involved. So yeah, it's important. And one of the things that I try to bring to the team that to help build that confidence on asking questions is sometimes I will be very out in the open and say, I don't know. Sometimes there's a question where, hey, Marcelo, what do we do next? And I'm like, I'm going to have to get back to you on this one because you bring a great question. I haven't done this before. I don't know. One thing I will promise them, because that's something that I love doing, is I will learn. I love learning. That's for me is my hobby. It's my after hours thing, is like watching some YouTube tutorial sometimes on how to fix a gate, to how to build a rocket ship or whatever. But learning, I think, is a very important trait for a leader too, because it's not reasonable to think that you know everything, right? It's you don't. And if you do, you're not doing anything interesting, yeah, because exactly. You're just repeating a formula, which it's not exciting to me, at least.
No, it's not either to me. And it's, yeah, and realistically, you just realize that nobody knows for real. And that's it. You just realize that everybody's figuring that out as we go. And that's it. That's the beauty of it. I have a question for you. If you were to take a company like Manscaped back from its early days to where it is today, what path would you take in today's environment? Would you do it the same way?
I think so. Of course, there are learnings. And in retrospect, if we knew what growth looks like, which in your scenario, we would, I would strengthen a few foundations for what I know we need now, right? So it would make my present job a little easier. But in general terms, honestly, I think Manscaped has had a great path. I joined the company roughly 4.5, almost 5 years ago. The company had 2 years before I joined, or a year and a half, something like that. And when I joined, I was extremely excited with what had been done before me. And so I had nothing but a ton of respect when I got there. And I was like, man, this group of people really shine. So I don't know if I would rewrite history. I would just prepare for my future job a little better, because, hey, if I know, of course, there are learnings. But in essence, I think it was a great path and has been a great path. And I think there's a lot of great runway in front of us too.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. Take a taboo product category, put it into the light with a humoristic tone, hammer the heck out of YouTube. I remember I read like an article, I don't know if it was a CEO of your CEO that wrote it, but how they calculated like projected CPMs on YouTube and the whole machine they had to calculate how much to pay an influencer. And it was a beauty, right? It was very performance driven, but the wordplay was hilarious. They gave a lot of creative space to creators, where I think that's the edge smaller brands have, is like larger brands get tied up into brand guidelines that don't end. And I feel like that's the edge. If you're like, hey, creator, do whatever you want, make it funny, address it to your audience, and that's all we ask from. I think that's what made Manscaped what it is, because like it was always funny placements native to the creator themselves, not like reading from a script or a teleprompter. And I think that's what set Manscaped apart from the beginning. And I feel it's still part of your marketing ethos today.
I agree, David. And I can't take any credit for that, because that was a trait of Manscaped that was already built before even I joined. And that, I think, is one of the places where we really shine. Our podcast and influencer strategy, when I got exposed to it, I felt like this is brilliant, not only in the way that it was thought out, but also in the execution. Like, it's a very, like, there is an obsession for a good execution in those channels. And I, like I said, the team that created this and that runs this is it's an amazing team of really like people that love what they're doing, hard workers. And I think we really shine at this. My challenge, on the other hand, is exactly like developing that same success in now, like more, not only on the omnichannel support for marketing, but how do we get to specific, for example, retail activations, retail strategies on the long term with the same level of obsession and innovation and quality that we did with the early channels that I think, in a sense, I think there's a lot of things that we pioneered in those spaces, in the podcast and influencer space. It, again, can't take any credit for, but I'm a huge supportive fan and I learned a lot from what we do in those spaces.
Yeah, and I feel like using that ethos as part of your next marketing activation just makes sense because it worked, right? And there's not a lot of, again, there's not a lot of old school TV brands going over the edge with other types of activation, whether it's traditional media or whatnot. And it just drives eyeballs and it works. And yeah, I think it's a
huge... Yeah. And I think you bring a point that for me is important also for this rebalance that I call, because I don't like to call transition because I don't think we are letting go of anything. It's just like how we rebalance our marketing efforts. But I think it's important to have the disambiguation between performance-driven marketing and digital marketing and or traditional channels versus like digital channels or the podcast influencer channels. I think that what has been developed in terms of the digital channels, the influencer strategy, podcast, organic social, I think this is something that is not going back for the foreseeable future. And I think there's no need to rebalance in that sense. I do think that the media share, like how we put our money in which channels, is not going back. Of course, there is always chances for fine-tuning, but it's not that going towards a stronger omni-channel support means necessarily going back to traditional media plans, right? It's more about how we create the campaigns and the messages and how do we directly support, create a better support for all the channels that we sell our products in, but not necessarily like a media composition. It does impact the media composition. I'm not saying that it doesn't change things, but I'm saying it needs to be treated with in different ways. I think it's very easy to think about like a podcast read or an influencer activation as performance because a lot of that is used for that, but it's not necessarily. You can do great brand activations in those channels. It's important to separate these two as you are comparing.
Yeah, because it's, and then because if you hear a brand name like 7-8 times from different podcasters you listen to, there's an impact to that. The equivalent in TV world would be seeing the same commercial multiple times in different TV channels. And that was it. That creates, there's something in it that like, can't just look at promo code usage and say, oh, this has driven X amount of sales, because that's not a proper metric. And that's a good question to how do you change the culture of people that report on CAC, ROAS, CPA, whatever the metric is, and start to bake in that kind of media value? Like, how do you think about that? How do you adjust your reports? Because I'm assuming you're just transitioning smoothly, like gradually add brand metrics in there. And then
no, you touched the key point for sure. And I believe that you need to change the metrics because it doesn't matter how much you can tell a message and give direction if you're still measuring that professional's performance on a metric that is not aligned with what you're trying to do. It's just human nature. Like you're giving mixed signals, right? Because you're telling something but measuring the performance against something else. And two, people care about their work. They care about how they are reviewed or graded or measured, and they want to do a good job. So it's just natural that whatever metric you set is where people are going to go. I know we don't have visuals here, but I use one slide to talk about this with the team. Is, I don't know if you've been to Amsterdam. One of the things in Amsterdam that is very distinctive on its architecture is that you're going to see a lot of very thin and tall houses, like the buildings, especially like downtown, there's a ton of thin and tall buildings. And then you ask, like, why was that like an architecture movement? Is there, how is that like, why that city has such a characteristic architecture. And at least what I learned in my studies, because I'm a curious guy, was that at some point in history, your tax property was measured by the width of your house. So that metric influenced the look of a whole city, because now people are building like the thinnest house possible and super tall. They even get to a point, and I do have in my slides, there's a house that I found online that is literally like the width of a door. It's like, it's the thinnest house I've ever seen. And that guy probably is exempt from property taxes. But you see how the metric influences a lot. Like how you measure things will dictate a lot of people's behavior. So yes, you need to fix that. You need to align. If you're changing your objectives, your metrics need to be aligned with that. Otherwise, it's going to be just a waste of time. You're going to be talking, but people are going to do differently.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. If you keep reporting on these metrics that are old school in your way of thinking, it's just going to bring you back to what you were doing. And
yep.
Marcelo, we're arriving at our hard stop. It was a real pleasure chatting with you. Lots of insights. One quick question before you go. How are you planning Black Friday and Cyber Monday?
Man, I think we start planning for this the day that it ends, like the year prior, right? So we do put a lot of effort on holiday. Our products do resonate really well with that season, because I think there is a very interesting component about Manscaped, and especially on the growing products, but I think it bleeds through all the categories that we are in right now. But in the beginning, like you said, when you are, you know, trying to promote a new behavior, men to take better care down there, we had to use a lot of humor to kind of facilitate that conversation. But what we also learned is that it facilitates conversation between two people as well, not just between us and the consumer. So we have a lot of partners that are very elegant, nice, and gifting way to say, hey, maybe I could use you taking better care down there, is gifting one of our groin trimmers. Again, that's just one of the aspects of the holiday gifting season. And also at the same time, like moms that are having their sons grow up, hair start to pop up in different places. Sometimes they're not taking care down there yet. And some moms have a hard time having that conversation. So a beautiful way of doing it is, hey, holiday season's coming. I know what gift I'm going to give to my husband, to my son. So anyway, we do have a ton of messages. We do have a very strong campaign that we launch every year at holiday. It is a very important time for us. And I think it's one of those like all hands on deck. Everyone's like full attention. And I think it's proven to be like a great gift, and it's has a lot of traction in that season. So I think the preparation is just, it's a year long preparation. It's not something that we do like the weeks before. And it's an effort that it's evergreen around the company, but it's all hands on deck during that specific time.
Yeah. Cause revenue is like some 50%+ of revenues during that season, if not more.
Yeah.
We work with. So it's a definite investment, and yeah.
It is. It's a little nerve-wracking every year, right? But hey, that's what we do. Like when I did the election and the political campaigns, I think that's where I see the relationship, because it's almost like everything that you prep for in the election day, that's when it's going to be proved out. Of course, as we evolve, it becomes less of that, but we still have that component of this is where we prove out everything that we've been prepping for. The holiday season still carries that weight, even if less and less every year, which is good for business, but less. And I'm saying as we compare to how we sell throughout the year, but it has that component. So yes, it feels like election night for me.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like that. It feels exhausting. This season is at the end of the Black Friday, Cyber Monday craze. Like our team feels exhausted with all this stuff we have to do. And it's part of the game we play. And Marcelo, thanks a lot. And where can people find you?
Well, me, I'm So I'm not like, I'm a little shy. I know it doesn't show here, but I think LinkedIn is usually like for the professional crowd that wants to touch base with Manscaped and when what we're doing in our marketing, things that we are participating on. I think that's a good place. But I do think that connecting to manscaped.com and learning more about the brand and what we've been doing and the products that we have, our categories expansion is something that tells a lot about Manscaped. But yeah, I think LinkedIn is a good place to reach out if there's question messages or things.
Yeah, I think you guys have been killing it on category expansion. And I feel like there's a lot of brand love that can translate to a lot of revenue as long as the products are good, right?
Yeah.
Congratulations on all the success. And it was a pleasure chatting.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure in my end too. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Growth Notes. You can find links to all the resources mentioned in today's episode in the show notes. If you're finding value in our podcast, please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps us reach more listeners like you. Don't miss out on any insights. Keep listening and growing with us.